From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, another installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the situation facing the new Soviet Republic after the Russian Revolution in 1917. Luciana, we left off last week
with the new economic policy. I think that your idea that we should look at the response, the political response to when Lenin introduced that into the Soviet Union at that time, the criticism in particular from what was termed the left, it has an awful lot that resonates today with the same kinds of criticisms being leveled against the only socialist countries practicing right now in the world.
Yes, that's right. So I wanted to emphasize the significance historically to us of what happened in 1921 October when Lenin defended or gave reason for the shift from war communism to the new economic policy. And so in his report on October 17, 1921, it becomes clear that for us the historical significance of the new economic policy was that the Bolsheviks recognized with that policy, at least Lenin did, and the party that supported him, not Trotsky, that there will be, this is the important fact, that there will be no direct transition from the old Russian economy to state production and distribution along communist lines, he said. So that translates it into, we must not count on going straight to communism. They realized that. They admitted that. We cannot go straight to communism. I think this is even more important for countries such as Russia and China, both of which Russia was underdeveloped and China was a colony.
Right.
So how was it going to go?
Yeah, I mean, just for people to understand this, let me interrupt for a second. I mean, you want to look at this communist ideal, quote unquote. We're looking at Marx's from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Well, when the historical development of the economy hasn't placed enough things to distribute according to needs, then you cannot, yes, you can't have that dynamic. You first have on the table the development of the productive forces so that there is this bank of things that can be distributed according to people's needs and that would rest only on drawing on people's abilities rather than that which is necessary. So the material basis, in other words, for communism, for pure communism, whatever term you want to use, for this maxim doesn't exist until you build it. And there's a lot of work between the feudal societies that Russia's economy and China's economy presented more or less at revolution and when the communist revolution actually took place.
Exactly. Because the assumption is, okay, we have the revolution, now we distribute the goods, we attend to the needs of the people.
Right.
Instead of the first thing that must be considered is what you just mentioned, where are the goods going to come from?
Right.
But the second thing is to make sure that the power of the proletariat, let's use the classical word, is strengthened. And that can only mean developing the economy, right?
Right. I mean, that would be the purpose of it, really. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so I think it's worth quoting at length a paragraph from his report in which he says the following, and it's several lines. So he says, we made a mistake of deciding to go over directly to communist production and distribution. We thought that under the surplus food appropriation system, which we had under war communism, the peasants would provide us with the required quantity of grain, which we could distribute among the factories and thus achieve communist production and distribution. That, unfortunately, is a fact that is a fact of our assumption.
Right.
I say unfortunately because brief experience convinced us that that line was wrong, and moreover, that it ran counter to what we had previously written and theorized about the transition from capitalism to socialism, namely that it would be impossible to bypass the period of socialist accounting and control in approaching even the lower stage of communism. Ever since 1917, when the problem of taking power arose and the Bolsheviks explained it to the whole people, our theoretical literature has been definitely stressing the necessity for a prolonged, complex transition through socialist accounting and control from capitalist society, and the less developed it is, the longer the transition will take
right.
to even one of the approaches to communist society.
Right. I mean, it's obvious. If you consider, you know, we don't see these things, we don't have examples. And certainly Lenin didn't have examples at the time to draw upon, but when you actually ponder the task of providing the goods that the members of society need, you realize this is, as you know, it's obvious that you can't get from here to there without traveling the road from here to there, in essence.
Yeah, that's right. I find it also very interesting that he mentions so early, which is now the case of China in 1959, the less developed a nation is, the longer the transition will take. And it amuses me to think that the most developed industrially country in the world is the United States now. Well, was.
right, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that really we have here in the United States everything we need to start socialism from a very advanced stage of development. All we need to do is take over the means of production, the banking system. Everything is so well developed. It's
right.
ready. We can start socialism right tomorrow.
Right. It's,
except there is one big obstacle, and that is that there is no consciousness of that possibility among the people, because I think the propaganda machine has been in action since 1920s, building, you know, it has realized, the ruling class, I think, realized very early on in the 1920s that the danger in the United States was great. It had a great, you know, it had a working class organization. It had kept up one of the greatest labor struggles in the world. I mean, the American history of labor, it's amazing. We just don't know it. And I think that the propaganda that has been conditioning us to despise socialism, to be afraid, to threaten, that is century-long, and it started right after 1917.
Right.
Because I think the danger of socialism in the United States, though we don't ourselves know it, is to them very real. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. We have a couple of the relatively recent indicia of this. I mean, okay, we can go back to the 80s and, the retrenchment that took place in the United States
yeah.
and in the UK, you know, represented by Reagan and Thatcher and all of that. And then the so-called collapse, in any event, the taking apart of the Soviet Union, the reorientation of China, you know, in other words, China is basically its NEP, its version of an NEP on a massive scale.
Yep.
All of this, the end of history, you know, that was the propaganda line that Marx was completely refuted and repudiated. Socialism is runs counter to human nature. That's that, end of story. And, of course, more recently, we saw in the United States and moving globally, and it's interesting that it started here, the Occupy movement, and the center of that, the essentially the philosophical kernel, was the idea of class, the 1% and the 99%. And in some ways, some people looking at it as a crude approximation of Marxism, and others maybe an update, because, you know, the proletariat as it existed in the 19th century, of course, is not exactly the class that comprises the bulk of the 99% now, and nor is the petty bourgeoisie, by the way, who have been largely reduced to pauperism or membership in the working class. So we saw that. We saw when Obama was running, when they were calling him a communist, every time they started doing that, or a socialist, he started going up in the polls. And we saw that happen with Sanders as well, that people were not only not afraid of the idea of socialism, but if someone called themselves one, even if they weren't, it had cachet, and they go up in the polling. So, you know, we're seeing a revival of some sort of class consciousness in the United States, I think.
Yeah, and I think I also think that they knew this would happen in the 70s when they were planning this, what I call, well, what is the reaction, the counter-revolution to the counter-revolution to the gains that the working class people and civil society, if you want to call it that, had achieved since 1945.
Right.
I think they knew that there would be a backlash, a furious, eventually, a rebellion by the people. And I think that Obama, and particularly Obama, have put in place all sorts of, well, it started with the, what you call it, the Patriot Act, putting all sorts of mechanism to suspend civil rights, to clamp down on us.
Right.
And we've seen this in the Hamburg, recently in the Hamburg events, how fierce the police reaction was, how organized. And everywhere where you have, whatever you think of those groups, everywhere where the G20 and the other cabals meet, there are expressions of rebellion against these people that have started this counter-revolution, I should say.
Yeah.
And it's inevitable that the word socialism will emerge. And has emerged. It's just that the end of history is just a tremendous expression, in my view, of triumphalism on one hand and kind of covert fear on the other. A specter haunts this project. So, yeah, and that's good. It's good to remember. To go to do what we just did,
okay,
to gloss over what I was reading from Lenin. So, you know, I pick up from the less developed a nation is, the longer the transition will take, and I suggested that they would take a shorter transition in the United States if we could only.
Right.
Proceed along these small, along the road to socialism, which we have signs that people are interested in.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah,
okay.
There are contradictions too, I agree, definitely.
Yeah. It is also important to note that Lenin was quite aware that this new economic policy, which introduced market measures, capital investment, etc., not that he got much from the outside. It's important to realize how he saw it as a defeat, but also a strategic retreat in response to the economic defeat. So again, I want to quote him. He said, "New economic policy signifies that we have started a strategic retreat." We said, in effect, "Before we are completely routed, let us retreat and reorganize everything, but on a firmer basis. If communists deliberately examine the question of the new economic policy, there cannot be the slightest doubt in their minds that we have sustained a very severe defeat on the economic front." Now that's facing truth. Mm. You know? Yeah. You got to face those facts. Yeah. And then he goes on. "The surplus food appropriation system in the rural districts, that is the, yeah, what was the word? What was the word we used last time? The correct word for the appropriation? Do you remember?
Oh, maybe we don't. I don't know, the conscription or the
reappropriation. I can't remember the word.
Yeah, I forgot that. Yeah,
but anyway, it's here. The appropriation, the direct communist approach to the problem of urban development, hindered the growth of the productive forces and proved to be the main cause of the profound economic and political crisis that we experienced in the spring of 1921. What he means by that is that in the country, that the surplus food appropriation, distance the peasants from the revolution or from the party, that it created hoarding and distrust, that it wasn't enough to feed the city anyway because of the hoarding, etc. So then you had this division between the peasants and the workers, the very basis of the state, the hammer and sickle, as you pointed out in a previous interview, that this force on which the revolution depended was actually divided
by
this appropriation and this direct communism.
Right.
Now, he goes on. And in 1921, there had also been a failure of the crops and the drought. So everything depended on agriculture. Okay, that, and he continues, "That was why we had to take a step which, from the point of view of our line, of our policy, cannot be called anything else than a very severe defeat and retreat. Moreover, it cannot be said that this retreat is, like retreats of the Red Army, a completely orderly retreat to previously prepared position." In other words, the economic front is a lot more involving, a lot more strenuous than actually the battles. And he was aware of the risks of introducing this policy. It isn't, you know, there are some people that think this was a proposal for how to build socialism for the end of forever. I mean, I've had those objections.
Right.
I mean, those assumptions that this was Lenin's proposal, let's return to capitalism and this is how we will build communism. This is a strategic retreat.
Right.
This is an attempt to hold the revolution together. How are you going to get the peasants on our side? How are you going to feed the workers?
Right.
I'm trying not to go into tangents.
But you know, you have though this, you know, this, you have this problem that you face when you actually govern. And this is, you know, you had on the one hand a party that had done all kinds of organizing and all kinds of political work, and you know, was invested in and trying to become one with working class, and also to made a strategic alliance with the peasants. And then suddenly, now we have to govern and be sort of the clearinghouse to make sure everyone has food, clothing, shelter. Mm-hmm. Well, where do we get it from? And the reality of that sets in. And so you have this ideal on the one hand, which Marxism is supposed to sort of eschew, idealism for, you know, for the material reality. And on the other hand, as opposed to the ideal, the practical problems facing the society, such as where do we get our food from and how do we make it sustainable?
Yep, exactly. And he even admits here that we had even the theory, you know, that we must pass through the phase of capitalism. But then we had war communism, and now we realize we can't go straight. So what I'm saying is that, yes, faced with material conditions, the theory gets, you know, either goes out the window, gets amended, or whatever.
Right.
But they did have the theory, you know? And the big mistake was to say, but there were very many reasons for it, let's just do direct communism right away. And this is what's important in the report by Lenin, is that it reminds us that, yes, we had the theory, then we strayed from it. Now material condition has drummed it. Theory is theory, but when the material condition drum it into your head, then it becomes vital.
Right. Well, this is science. You know, people refer to Marxism as scientific socialism. This is how science works. You start with your hypothesis, and you test it in the real world, and you adjust your hypothesis to the material world.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's emotionalism and idealism.
Right.
Okay, so let's proceed to, did he know the risks he was taking in promoting this policy? Because we're not interested whether it failed or triumphed. It was short-lived. It was 3 years. That doesn't matter. It's the questions that it raised. You know what I mean,
yes.
Right? It's important to us to know that, for one fact, that in underdeveloped countries, you can't go straight to communism. That's important. And since these very revolutions have happened in underdeveloped countries, we better go back and take a look at, you know, what they were facing.
Right.
For people who say, oh, China is capitalist, you know, and things like that, they have to think about what's behind the history of the policies that they undertake. But anyway, did he know the risk? And he put the question this way. He said, in allowing the peasants to sell the surplus grain, in allowing a free market, in other words, there is a risk. And he asks, who will gain? The capitalist that's inside Russia? The capitalist or the proletarian class?
Right.
Who will take advantage of the new situation first? He says. The whole question is, this is crucial. Whom will the peasantry follow? The proletariat, which wants to build a socialist society, or the capitalist, who says, let us turn back, it is safer that way, we don't know anything about the socialism they have invented. Who will gain? But he says, well, if capitalism gains by this new economic policy, industrial production will grow. Okay, this is theoretical, because people could come and say, no, it won't. There are other places where there was no passage through capitalism. I doubt it.
Right.
But some people say that.
Right.
So you know, this, we have to acknowledge that, that this is theory. On the one hand, on the other hand, if capitalism gains by it, industrial production will grow. And the proletariat will grow, too. So what Lenin is interested in is in building the strength of the proletariat state, not necessarily immediately attending to the need, to the needs. Another thing that's missing in idealist conceptions is that the masses are considered as passive recipients. This is not communist ideology to expect the proletarians to be given socialism.
Right.
They must build it. They must make it themselves. And to make it themselves, there are enormous sacrifices, including what they accuse China of doing, exploiting their own workers. Okay? But exploiting them for what ends? To exploit them in profit?
Right.
Or to secure the proletarian state?
Right.
You really think that socialism will come out like manna from heaven and bless the workers without their sacrifices, their sacrifices for future generations, to ensure that the proletarian state will not be overthrown? Okay, back to Lenin. So who will take the advantage? So he says, well, you know, if the capitalist gains, industrial production will grow, and the proletariat will grow too. The capitalists will gain from our policy and will create an industrial proletariat, which in our country, owing to the war and the desperate poverty and ruin, has become de-classed. It's not a class anymore.
Right.
It's dislodged from its class groove and has ceased to exist as a proletariat as a result of all this civil war, etc. The proletariat is the class which is engaged in the production of material values in large-scale capitalist industry. Since large-scale capital industry has been destroyed, particularly in the civil war, since the factories are at a standstill, the proletariat has disappeared. It has sometimes figured in statistics, but it has not been held together economically.
Right. And it's an economic class. Let's remember that. So if there's no economic glue binding it together, then it does not hold together.
Exactly. And, you know, so he says further that the rest, this is again a leap of theory, and yes, it has to be debated. Somebody told me recently, well, gone are the times where even Lenin was infallible. But he never considered himself infallible. He wasn't. He admits it. So it's not a question of that. So he says, the restoration of capitalism would mean the restoration of a proletarian class engaged in the production of socially useful material. Socially useful material values,
right,
in big factories employing machinery and not in profiteering. You know, the restoration of capital in Russia is not for allowing profiteering.
Right.
It is for producing socially useful materials.
Right.
Not in making cigarette lighters for sale, but in work that is very useful, he says.
Yep.
So that can be debated, but that's a risk, okay? That's the risk involved. And then finally, he also underscores, in the whole question of who will take the lead within this opportunity, within this policy of opening up to the market, and to capitalism,
And this is the question that Russia faced, for example, in the 1990s and has been grappling with, and China. And we can pick it up there next week. Luciana, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Pleasure all mine, Don. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.